This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup, with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now, here's national correspondent Dan Rabib.
2005, a lot of bad news, according to our CBS anchor, Bob Schieffer. We'll chat with Bob in a moment. First, some sounds of this year. The powerful and disruptive winds of Hurricane Katrina. The levee broke and New Orleans was flooded. In Rome, Pope John Paul died.
Santo Padre Giovanni Paolo II è tornato alla casa del padre.
He was buried, and then a German pope was elected. He took the name Benedict, a new danger from Asia. Millions of chickens and other birds had to be killed because avian flu was spreading. If it spreads human to human, it could be a big worldwide danger.
Roberts, no.
Controversies in America included President Bush's Supreme Court nominees. John Roberts was confirmed as Chief Justice. Harriet Myers had to bow out. In January, Sam Alito will be questioned by the Senate. In California, Michael Jackson's fans cheered outside a courthouse. He showed up in pajamas once. He was acquitted. In London, terrorists bombed the subway and bus system. Four British suicide attackers. An even worse disaster in northern Pakistan and India. An earthquake in October that killed around 100,000 people. And amazing good news in Chicago. A World Series victory. Not for the Cubs. Those were White Sox fans singing about being champions. Our first year-end report comes from Baghdad. CBS News correspondent Cammy McCormick.
The year began with hope. Millions of Iraqis defied the insurgents and made their way to polling places in January in the first democratic election in 30 years.
Good for Iraqi and for the people.
For President Bush, it was a proud achievement.
Congratulate the Iraqi people. Thank you for meeting this milestone. Thank you for doing what is right to set the foundation for peace for future generations.
But even as the new political process got underway, the violence returned. Many believe it was fueled by the fact that so many Sunnis stayed away from the polls and felt alienated from their new government. The targets of insurgents were often Shiites. The trial of Saddam Hussein also got underway. He remained defiant, insisting he's still the country's president.
I will not answer the so-called tribunal, and I will preserve my constitutional right to remain silent.
But the U.S. hopes bringing the former dictator to justice will help heal some of the country's wounds and set it on the path to recovery. Cammy McCormick, CBS News.
We're pleased to be joined by the anchor of the CBS Evening News, Bob Schieffer. And Bob, there were two very different challenges that America had to face this year, the continuing war in Iraq and the crisis triggered by Hurricane Katrina. Iraq and Katrina, how'd we do?
Well, I think that there's one word that you could use to describe 2005. It is disaster. Natural disasters and political disasters. Katrina, of course, and the aftermath, where, frankly, we saw a collapse of government at every level. And then the disasters politically that befell the Bush White House, everything from leak investigations to Supreme Court nominations that had to be withdrawn and on and on. I guess if there is any good news at all to talk about this year, and frankly, for the first time in a long time, there really wasn't a lot, I think it is the fact that the Iraqis did have three elections, and that is, when you stop and think about it, a rather remarkable thing.
How do you gauge the mood of the American people? Frankly, they turned a lot to entertainment, not so much to Hollywood movies this year. You know, there was a slump there because people can get DVDs and iPods and all sorts of other ways of entertaining themselves. But some people think that Americans are into distracting themselves with so much bad news.
There's no question when things are going badly, people do look for things to kind of change the subject for a little bit. This is a country that is very divided over what direction we ought to be going in, very divided over whether we ought to be in Iraq and how long we ought to be there, and very upset, frankly, with the services that they're getting from government at every level. And I think you saw that hit a boiling point after Katrina. Democrats believe they really now have a chance to regain control, at least in the House of Representatives. It's a long shot, always, when that happens, but I think that is possible.
Host of Face the Nation, anchor of the CBS Evening News, Bob Schieffer, thanks so much for joining us, and Happy New Year to you.
Same to you.
Near the end of the year, the Bush administration was celebrating the fact that the Iraqi parliamentary election went smoothly, and there were indications from U.S. officials that could lead to cutting the number of U.S. troops in Iraq, maybe by a lot, and maybe soon. We turn to CBS News national security correspondent David Martin at the Pentagon. White House officials did not deny all through the year that the slumping opinion poll ratings for President Bush's job in general, but especially for his performance in Iraq and how the war is going, really put pressure on the administration. Was that felt at the Pentagon also?
Well, certainly the pressure was felt to start talking about the plan. There was a plan that I think was drafted by General Casey in Iraq, independent of political pressure here back in the United States, but it was not talked about in the run-up to the December 15th election because Casey was afraid that that would give the Iraqi population perception that the American troops were getting ready to cut and run. All that changed when John Murtha, the Democrat on the House Defense Appropriations Committee, came out with that emotional call for a very swift withdrawal of American troops. It didn't change the plan, but it sure did change the willingness of Pentagon officials to talk about the plan.
David, comment on this. National security is such a concern, especially since 9/11. It's been spotlighted. Americans want to feel safe, but when they learn about the expense of a war on terrorism, some people aren't supportive.
You know, it's not just dollars. It's the expense of losing lives. I think that, more than the cost in dollars, is what gives people pause. Is this war really worth it? And if you were to ask somebody in the military, I think what they would say is, look, 3,000 Americans were killed on 9/11. Something like 2,150 Americans have been killed in Iraq. So we've been fighting the war on terror now. We're going into our fifth year with the start of 2006, and we have not lost the amount of people that we lost in a single day. And I think it just comes down to the eye of the individual, whether those lives are worth it. And it will probably come down in the end to what kind of government and what kind of country both Afghanistan and Iraq turn into. And the verdict is still out on that.
At the Pentagon, CBS News national security correspondent David Martin. Happy New Year, David, and thank you.
Well, thank you.
Up next, in depth, Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans and the Gulf Coast.
Stay with us. The CBS News year-end roundup will be right back. This is the CBS News year-end roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
America came under attack August 29th in New Orleans. Hurricane Katrina, approaching as a maximum Category 5, weakened a little but made an almost direct hit. The levees protecting the city broke, and CBS News was covering a crisis that got worse and worse.
I have what can only be described as bullet holes in the window in the room where I'm at. You can hear the debris hit the window with the sort of ping.
The downtown area is a mess. There's no power, water is limited, and streets are blocked by debris.
A tree 30 feet high is about to topple over. You can see the root ball just coming up out of the earth, the intensity of the wind blowing it over, a power line dangling from the top of this two-story hotel. Already part of the roof has been blown off.
We don't have no police protection out here. They're not out here nowhere. We don't have no food, no water. Supposed to be sending 500 buses to pick us out of here, and they ain't came yet.
It's really sad down here. It's chaotic down here. It is a mess, and everybody wants to talk about the looters, the looters. Well, don't worry about the looters. The looters are helping us to survive.
I just watched a suspected looter come out of a store where the glass is all broken out. One police officer pulled up in an unmarked car. Then four other officers responded in the marked cars. They talked to the man for a while, found out that he was just taking clothes for his family. They gave him a stern warning and sent him on his way.
We are dealing with one of the worst natural disasters in our nation's history. The vast majority of New Orleans, Louisiana is underwater. Tens of thousands of homes and businesses are beyond repair.
The bathrooms is in deplorable conditions. You got babies crying. They're so sad looking in the face, look like they're becoming dehydrated and malnutrition.
This recovery will take a long time. This recovery will take years.
There is a house in New Orleans.
Thousands of houses became unlivable. Well, over a million people left southern Louisiana. 10 days after Katrina struck, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin had the police and National Guard ordering residents to leave.
The troops are going to convince them to move because it's really not safe. And I know the spirit of New Orleanians. They said, look, the water's going to go down, we'll recover. I'll figure out a way to make this work. But this is like nothing that has ever happened in the world.
When the rain came, then the high winds, then the flood, poor people had no way to leave. The world saw on TV African Americans suffering.
They told us go to the Superdome. If you want to be rescued, go to the Superdome. Now they're telling us go to the bridge. Oh, we have very few resources. What are we supposed to do?
A blow to the image of our country, and Mayor Nagin was getting angry.
You probably have thousands of people that have died and thousands more that are dying every day.
The official death count much later was just over 1,000, bad enough. But many in New Orleans still believe more lives were lost, while the well-to-do had left, mostly before Katrina arrived.
Have wheels, will travel. So I got my car tanked up, and if all else fails, I got my bicycle.
We've got oil, we've got water, we've got food. Pray for us. Pray for all of New Orleans.
This was the disaster feared for decades. New Orleans, below sea level, filling like a bowl. Prayers were unanswered.
People are calling, oh Lord, where the Lord is, Jesus, Jesus. And I tell them that Jesus doesn't work here anymore.
One pastor at Sunday services said,
perhaps this is God's way of stripping us of many things to allow us to realize what is truly important.
With thousands homeless in the Superdome and the convention center, reports of looting and violence. For the CBS News team, it was like some uncivilized country.
We're seeing convoys of trucks pulling boats heading toward the Ninth Ward, where there are reports of people trapped on rooftops. Helicopters are flying overhead, and now a thick column of black smoke coming from somewhere in downtown New Orleans. There is no water to put out a fire and no water pressure. Here in the French Quarter, tourists are standing around discussing how to get out. There is no gas, and some are calculating how much they've got in their tanks and how far that would get them.
Louisiana.
There's a lot of work to be done. And we're going to continue working with the local and state people to get it done.
I'm Peter King in Meridian, Mississippi. When they find bodies, they can't always identify them because they've been exposed for a week or longer and have been rapidly decomposing in the heat. One county supervisor says that you can't tell sometimes if they're male or female, black or white.
There was no organization prior to the storm coming to ground as far as mobilizing assets, pre-positioning people, pre-positioning resources.
Thousands who left New Orleans came this way and stopped. They are now residents of Baton Rouge. Jessica Davis is here with her husband and six children. She's trying to limit any emotional trauma.
Mainly for the children, if not for anything else. We're just trying to get them back in school, trying not to keep them out of school too long. You know, they really need to get into some type of normality.
We need to get this garbage off the street before it starts making people ill.
Sitting in an RV in front of my house, water in the house, an awful, awful stench from the flooding. I'm faced with the task of tearing out my own carpeting, putting it by the curb. They tell us we have to empty the refrigerator. Oh, a god-awful smell is coming from it.
All those smart business guys out there who will see how we have or have not done this right and have some fancy computer matrix. Get down here and get some damn gas here and come down here and get the phones working.
Human contact with the floodwater should be avoided as much as possible.
They came knocking.
Louisiana State Police.
On numerous streets throughout New Orleans, law enforcement officials went door to door telling people who have stayed that they have to leave.
Mandatory evacuation is going to be in effect. Anybody seen back here will be considered as a looter.
I know what it means to miss New Orleans and me.
We mustn't forget that Mississippi's Gulf Coast was also devastated by Katrina, and that this was the worst hurricane season in recorded history. All 21 alphabetical names were used. Then the tropical storm names had to go Greek: Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, and Epsilon. And there was the economic impact on everyone. Oil and natural gas facilities were damaged, so gasoline and other fuel prices went sky high, while President Bush's opinion poll ratings fell to record lows from the day of his first visit to the disaster zone, when he praised FEMA director Michael Brown.
And Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Brown later was disgraced, had to resign. Within weeks, Congress agreed to provide more than $60 billion in aid, and the public donated a record more than $1 billion. The Mardi Gras celebration in the French Quarter is going to go ahead in February. Some in New Orleans speak of getting to a livable condition. They call it the new normal. One kid returning to school said his mother told him,
"It's about as normal as it's going to get."
The president declared a new national priority.
There is no way to imagine America without New Orleans, and this great city will rise again.
Dan Revive, CBS News.
Stay with us on the CBS News Year-End Roundup. This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revive.
Let's go back to New Orleans. We're joined by Dave Cohen, the news director at CBS radio affiliate WWL. You went through hell and back, of course, with Hurricane Katrina, and we just heard President Bush saying that your great city will rise again. What's the feeling, will it?
Well, I think there is an increasing optimism that it will. There's expected to be, in the early part of 06, a crush of population coming back. Mayor Ray Nagin expects right now about 100,000 people are living in New Orleans. He thinks that it'll be 200,000 by the end of January as more and more schools are opening up and more housing becomes available. There does seem to be an increasing sense of optimism that people will come back because, first and foremost, there's been a commitment that the levees will be restored and be stronger than ever.
Is that based on federal dollars?
It is largely based on the federal commitment that now they are saying there are designs, there are plans, and there is money, in fact, to make the levees stronger than ever and to be able to stand up to another Hurricane Katrina.
Will New Orleans be different? To be frank, fewer black people?
Yet to be seen. We know there will be what they're calling a smaller footprint, at least for the next 3 to 5 years, a smaller area where people will live within the city while the levees are strengthened, while they figure out which neighborhoods will rebuild and which ones won't. Who will come back is a very good question. Right now, the city appears to still be a majority black, and the mayor expects that it will stay that way. And so far, it looks like it will. Will it be 70% black as it was before Hurricane Katrina? I think that's yet to be seen.
What about the sense of fun? It's a great food and music capital. Are those businesses starting up again?
The part of the city that suffered the least damage and the least flooding was the what they call the old city, the historic parts of New Orleans that have become largely the tourist attractions. The central business district stretching into the French Quarter in uptown New Orleans. Many of the hotels, more than half of them, have reopened. Thousands of the restaurants are getting back up and running, and many of the tourist attractions. And they expect that by February for the Mardi Gras celebration, that there will be a very big push to have much of the tourism back up and running.
Dave Cohen at WWL Radio in New Orleans, we wish you a much happier new year.
Thank you very much.
Nature was unkind in other places, too. CBS's Jim Shenefy goes back 1 year to the disaster that struck Asia.
It was the morning after Christmas when the earth shook under the Indian Ocean off Indonesia. Most quakes last seconds. This one, magnitude 9.1, lasted close to 10 minutes. And then it got a whole lot worse. Tsunami, some 100 feet high. It devastated the shores of Indonesia, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and South India, and caused serious damage as far away as the east coast of Africa.
All we heard was this mighty bang, and the next thing in the place was flooding. It's up to there.
And killed as many as 275,000 people.
Dead bodies around, dead dogs all over the road.
A scene from man's worst nightmare.
It almost felt like we were driving into a newsreel from Nagasaki or Hiroshima.
But Mother Nature hadn't vented all her fury. On October 8th, a 7.6 magnitude quake hit the mountainous area between India and Pakistan known as Kashmir. Remote villages were destroyed. The death toll continues to grow and could be as high as 100,000.
Jim Shenady, CBS News.
On the plus side, there was a tremendous outpouring of charity. Americans and others contributed as never before. Also this year, terrorism. CBS's Steve Kathan.
Al-Qaeda and its sympathizers showed worldwide reach, even though there was no sign of Osama bin Laden in 2005.
People started to scream because it was a burning smell.
July 7th, London. Coordinated attacks on three subway stations and a bus.
Yeah, I just heard the explosion and turned around and saw the roof of the bus just sort of cartwheeling through the air.
52 people were killed. Then just 2 weeks later, some 90 dead in three bombings at resort hotels in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
The sky was lit up. It was terrible.
In October, bombings in Bali, Indonesia again targeted tourists. And Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, claimed responsibility for November suicide attacks in Amman, Jordan, angering Arabs.
They are not Muslims. That doesn't have anything with Islam. Islam is not like that.
President Bush insists the war on terror will be won.
We will never back down. We will never give in.
Steve Kathan, CBS News.
Now let's turn to the year in politics. We're joined by CBS News chief political correspondent Gloria Borger. You know, to me, this is the year when, and it's not something he wanted, George W. Bush became in many ways a lame duck. What do you think?
Well, it's kind of inevitable, Dan. This is his second term, and everybody always is sort of watching to see when the president starts to exhibit some amount of vulnerability. And I think we saw that this year in his approval ratings going down to record low levels. At one point, they were as low as somewhere around 38%. They now are inching back up. We also saw that his major domestic policy agenda, which was Social Security reform, has not been touched on Capitol Hill. And of course, there have been major questions about the prosecution of the war in Iraq, questions about weapons of mass destruction. And we have seen the president recently talk about mistakes that were made, about faulty intelligence, things that he has never said before, because there is a sense inside this White House that he needs to tell the American people that, yes, he was misinformed.
There also were questions of competence, not only about Iraq, but how Hurricane Katrina was handled. And that really hurt him. How many times, I mean, even here at CBS News, have we used that soundbite?
Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Him telling Michael Brown, then head of FEMA, that he was doing a heck of a job. It's embarrassing.
It is embarrassing. And I think it also gave way to some stories on the covers of news magazines talking about this president living in a bubble. There was one report that people who worked for the president actually had to give him a DVD showing him the tape of what was going on in Mississippi and in Louisiana.
Do you detect that there was a change in who was advising him and who might have been distracted? For instance, Karl Rove, his chief political advisor, was caught up in that Valerie Plame scandal. Who named the CIA agent?
I think that may be part of it, but that is a very simplified explanation. I think that these problems are very complex, and when you're going in many different directions at the White House, sometimes it's hard to be on top of every single fire that you've got to put out. Hurricane Katrina mushroomed very quickly into a huge story, not only a political story, but a social story, a cultural story, a story about the way we treat people in this country. And I think it is something that the president realized a few days too late that he needed to be really involved in. And that is, of course, why you saw him go down to New Orleans, why you see now the White House appropriating billions of dollars to rebuild the levees in New Orleans, while you see now FEMA on the case, and you see the White House admitting some culpability here, although also saying state and local officials are to blame.
CBS News national political correspondent Gloria Borger. And I'm Dan Revive in Washington.
This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup, a wrap-up of the year with the correspondents who cover the news on the CBS Radio Network. This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Reveal.
It was on January 20th, yes, in 2005, that George W. Bush was sworn in for his second term. Getting things done has been a challenge. Here's CBS News Chief White House Correspondent John Roberts.
It was a year that began on a high note for the president, reelected to his second term by a margin of over 3 million votes.
Let me put it to you this way. I earned capital in the campaign, political capital, and now I intend to spend it.
Okay, let's get to work.
The first few months went well enough as the president embarked on a campaign to sell changes to Social Security and begin to figure out tax reform. But as time wore on, that political capital evaporated. Social Security reform quickly stalled.
So help you God.
I do.
There were troubled nominations, his U.N. ambassador, and second pick for the Supreme Court. At the same time, fallout from the CIA leak was turning radioactive, and overlying everything, Iraq.
The deaths of three more American service members brought the total U.S. dead in the war to 2,000.
In its wake, Katrina left a ravaged Gulf Coast and a nation shocked by the images of poverty and neglect that it revealed.
To the extent that the federal government didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility.
There was some good news for the president. A strong economy, no terrorist attacks on U.S. soil, a chief justice who sailed through the confirmation process.
The Air Force, Marines...
A series of candid speeches on Iraq and a successful election saw dismal poll ratings begin to rise in early December. And no one should count this president out. But if he is to recover, say many Republicans, it may take the sort of White House staff shakeup that reinvigorated Ronald Reagan's second term.
John Roberts at the White House, now on a staff shakeup that President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney did not intend, a case still not closed. CBS News White House correspondent Peter Mayer.
The scandal known as the CIA leak case forced the departure of a top White House aide.
Today I accepted the resignation of Scooter Libby.
Louis Libby out for his alleged role in the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame.
He was at the beginning of the chain of the phone calls, the first official to disclose this information outside the government to a reporter, and that he lied about it afterwards, under oath. And repeatedly.
Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald announcing the charges against Libby in October. For Valerie Plame's husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, the charges were personal because of his very public criticism of the war.
This is an attempt on the part of the White House to cover up the web of lies that underpinned the justification for going to war in Iraq in the first place.
The scandal ensnared journalists who spoke with administration officials about war decisions, and it tested the credibility of the White House and Press Secretary Scott McClellan, who denied Libby and top Bush advisor Karl Rove leaked information.
Those individuals assured me they were not involved in this.
Karl Rove remains under investigation in the case. Peter Mayer, CBS News.
Mr. Bush did have an opportunity that presidents relish to name a new justice to the Supreme Court. Twice. Here's CBS's Barry Bagnato.
After more than a decade of stability, a year of change.
An opening on the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor is retiring.
President Bush finally had a chance to shape the bench.
I'll pick people who will strictly interpret the Constitution and not use the bench to legislate from.
His first choice, federal judge John Roberts.
Justice Roberts, no!
Protests fizzled as he won over senators.
I come before the committee with no agenda, no platform.
He was confirmed as Chief Justice after William Rehnquist, leader of the court's conservative revolution, died at 80. Conservatives revolted when the president next nominated his friend, White House counsel Harriet Myers, Kansas Senator Sam Brownback.
You had a number of outstanding potential nominees who are sitting judges.
She withdrew, opening the door for federal judge Samuel Alito.
He'll make a great Supreme Court justice.
Ads for and against him are running. Attention is focused on a Reagan administration memo he wrote.
The memo really is a roadmap around the constitutional right to an abortion, and it's going to complicate his hearing in January.
CBS News legal analyst Andrew Cohen. Barry Bagnato, CBS News.
The federal government has started preparing for a pandemic of bird flu. Could be disastrous if it gets here from Asia and starts spreading human to human. CBS's Nick Young reports.
Since its isolation in 1996, the deadly strain of flu known as H5N1 is blamed for killing at least 69 people.
The lethal capacity of this virus is very, very high.
Columbia University's Dr. Erwin Redlener.
We're only missing one more piece before it becomes a pandemic.
That piece is human-to-human transmission. So far, all deaths tied to the flu are believed to be the result of contact with sick birds, and so far, there are no signs the killer pathogen has turned up in this country. Still, many Americans are nervous, says Dr. Len Horvitz.
You can't imagine how many phone calls and requests I've had for prescriptions
advice.
I am concerned about avian flu.
But Illinois Senator Barack Obama says there must be more than presidential concern.
The United States cannot afford to have a Katrina level of preparedness.
Tens of millions of birds have been slaughtered abroad, and the U.S. has tightened restrictions on poultry imports. But Health Secretary Mike Leavitt concedes.
What we do know is that someday there will be a pandemic, and our preparation is not adequate.
Congress also took an interest in performance enhancement drugs used by athletes, especially in baseball. CBS's Dave Barrett reports.
The claim came on CBS's 60 Minutes.
National pastime is juice.
Former major leaguer Jose Canseco admitted using steroids and said he'd injected one-time Oakland teammate Mark McGuire. On St. Patrick's Day, Donald Hooten spoke at a congressional hearing.
Players that are guilty of taking steroids are not only cheaters, you are cowards.
Hooten's son died after suffering steroid-linked depression. At that hearing, retired slugger Mark McGuire did not answer personal questions.
Asking me or any other player to answer questions about who took steroids in front of television cameras will not solve the problem.
Baltimore's Rafael Palmeiro did speak up.
I have never used steroids, period.
5 months later, he was suspended for 10 days for failing a drug test. Palmeiro claimed,
I have never intentionally used steroids.
Fans reacted,
how can you accidentally take steroids? I'm sorry. I don't believe it.
Was there any honest baseball players left?
In November, baseball and Congress agreed on this. Fail a steroids test and it's a 50-game suspension. 100 games for a second offense. A third time, that's a lifetime ban. Dave Barrett, CBS News.
Winners and losers this year in entertainment. I'm Lisa Carlin of People Magazine. Everybody Loves Raymond signed off the air at the top last spring. In September, Ray Romano showed his staying power. His series beat red-hot Desperate Housewives for the Emmy Award for Best Comedy. Best Drama went to the new sensation, Lost. At the movies, Hilary Swank won her second Oscar, Morgan Freeman his first, and Clint Eastwood his fourth and fifth for Million Dollar Baby. Speaking of the Oscars, Billy Crystal is considered by many the quintessential host. But Chris Rock got high marks for his job hosting and for his new TV series. Billy Crystal, meanwhile, was having what he called the time of his life on Broadway with his Tony-winning show, 700 Sundays.
And the hardest thing I ever do is to get the show to Broadway. But the hardest thing is leaving.
Two of the year's most popular movies, the unique documentary March of the Penguins and the latest Harry Potter, which brings us to losers for the year. Hollywood. Audiences kept shrinking. The box office was down, sending movie makers this message. Theaters need to be more comfortable, popcorn needs to cost less, and movies need to be consistently better. Lisa Carlin, People Magazine, for CBS News.
Coming up, more on show business this year, including who died.
Stay with us. The CBS News Year-End Roundup will be right back. This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
We'll review the year in the music business in a moment, but first, the fate of Terri Schiavo was a big national issue in March. CBS's Peter King covered her final days.
We're here to pray for Terri Schiavo.
Nearly 15 years after a Florida woman suffered what doctors called irreversible brain damage, a long family feud finally reached its climax. Terri Schiavo's parents claimed she was responsive.
Mommy loves you.
They fought to keep her on life support.
Please save my little girl.
But husband Michael said that went against her wishes. The lawyers argued,
we believe Terri has said she wants to live.
Your Honor, this emergency motion is crossing the line.
The courts repeatedly sided with Michael Schiavo, so pro-life lawmakers, even the White House, tried to circumvent what they called activist judges.
I urge all those who honor Terri Schiavo to continue to work to build a culture of life.
Holy Mary, Mother of God.
Protesters, mostly from the religious right, held vigils, but a judge's order to stop nutrition March 18th stood. 13 days later,
she died at approximately 9 a.m.
An autopsy showed her doctors were right.
This damage was irreversible, and no amount of therapy or treatment would have regenerated the massive loss of neurons.
Now to the Middle East, a year of change. Israel gave the Gaza Strip to the Palestinians. CBS News Jerusalem correspondent Robert Berger, that was a rare unarmed military operation. How'd it go?
It actually went very well. There was a lot of turmoil leading up to the pullout, enormous opposition by nationalists and hawks who felt that this was a reward for terrorism. But then when push came to shove and the army went in there, it all ended very quickly. It was over in about 10 days. The reason that Israel pulled out of Gaza is simple. There were 8,000 Jews there living among more than a million Palestinians. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon felt that that was no longer viable. that those settlers were basically sitting ducks. He felt that if Israel pulled out of those areas, that it could withdraw to more defensible borders.
And that also puts pressure on the Palestinians, who have a new leader, Mahmoud Abbas, after the death in 2004 of Yasser Arafat. And Abbas plans elections in January. He's trying to be the leader not only in Gaza, but of course in the West Bank. How's that going?
Gaza is a test case for Palestinian statehood, and it's not going very well. It's clear that Mahmoud Abbas doesn't really have control. His security forces are no match, especially in Gaza, for the Islamic militant group Hamas. We saw that as soon as the Israelis pulled out, that Hamas got hundreds of thousands of people onto the streets for a celebration, and the Palestinian authorities' celebration was very small. There's basically armed chaos in Gaza, and Abbas, as much as he'd like to, hasn't been able to exert control over those militant groups that rule the streets.
And in Israel, Ariel Sharon, the prime minister, quit his Likud party, is forming a new party, and Israelis will vote in March.
He called early elections because he basically felt he could no longer govern in his hawkish Likud party because of rebels that were opposed to his Gaza pullout. Now, Sharon wants to continue that Gaza pullout by pulling Israel out of parts of the West Bank, again, to more defensible borders. According to the polls, he should win by a landslide.
Syria, the unfriendly neighbor to the northeast of Israel, had a lot of pressure this past year and withdrew its forces from Lebanon. Why did that happen?
The assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri nearly a year ago was the straw that broke the camel's back. Syria was implicated in that assassination. Syrian President Bashar Assad was already in trouble with Washington. The U.S. accused him of allowing terrorists to cross the border to join the insurgency in Iraq. So when he was cornered on the Hariri assassination, he basically caved in and pulled out of Lebanon.
So Lebanon, where there'd been so much trouble in the 1970s and 80s, is becoming a more peaceful and reliable country?
Well, Lebanon will certainly be more aligned to the West if it's not under Syrian control. Syria is one of the radical Arab states. It supports Palestinian terror groups. It supports the insurgency in Iraq. Now, if radical states are weakened, it could strengthen the forces of moderation in the Middle East, including Lebanon.
Iran is a player in Lebanon because Iran supports the Hezbollah guerrilla group, considered by many, including the U.S. government, to be terrorists. And meanwhile, Israel looks toward Iran as a danger in the future because of Iran's nuclear program.
Israel is very concerned about Iran, and even more so since the Iranian president came out with some very belligerent statements, including wiping Israel off the map, and that's a quote. And after that, he also denied the Holocaust, said Israel should be moved to Europe, and statements like that. That has made the Israelis very nervous. They're concerned that Iran is developing nuclear weapons, and that if it gets those weapons, it might use them against the Jewish state. Now, Israel has said that it won't allow Iran to get the atom bomb. It does not want to take a military action. It hopes that the U.S. and international community will do something first, but Israeli officials are hinting that there is a military option if diplomacy fails.
In Jerusalem, CBS News correspondent Robert Berger. Thanks and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Now, this year's popular music. CBS's Bill Vitka reports.
Kanye West was the master of the airwaves, along with 50 Cent. Live 8 was a call to conscience, one that reunited Pink Floyd. Scandal of the year was corporate payola. Flavor of the month, Crazy Frog, as a ringtone became a hit. We lost Luther Vandross, Bobby Short, Bluegrass King Jimmy Martin, Link Wray, Gapemouth Brown, and R.L. Burnside. Bad, you know. Chuck Berry collaborator Johnny Johnson. Fats Domino survived the New Orleans flood. Cream was reborn. The sunshine of your and the Doors drummer won a lawsuit to stop his bandmates from using the group's name to tour. When the music's over. Bill Fitka, CBS News.
Now, others who died this year, some more notable names we won't forget. Christopher Glenn of the CBS World News Roundup with that.
Jean Paul II, he loves you.
In April, the world lost a pope for the ages, John Paul II. In January,
here's Johnny.
No more, nor Anne Bancroft, Mrs. Robinson.
You're trying to seduce me.
Ossie Davis, Sandra Dee, Bob Denver, Virginia Mayo, The Riddler, Frank Gorshin. Architect Philip Johnson, Chicken King, Frank Perdue, civil rights icon Rosa Parks, lawyer Johnny Cochran.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Peter Jennings brought us the news.
News is really a mirror held up to society.
And Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal died.
It can happen again.
We mourn coach Hank Stram and Joe Lewis's legendary opponent, Max Schmeling, gone too, Arthur Miller, and black playwright August Wilson.
I have a lot to be angry about.
We'll miss Robert Moog, synthesizer inventor. I'm Christopher Glenn, CBS News.
That's the first of our special broadcasts reviewing the events of a busy 2005. Until the next part of the CBS News year-end roundup, I'm Dan Revive. Happy holidays and a joyous new year.
You've been listening to the CBS News year-end roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein. This is the CBS Radio Network.